So welcome everyone, to all the listeners and everyone that are out there. My name is Angie, and today we are actually, I'm really excited to talk to an LA-based person, Dr. Mauro Zapatera. He is actually obtained his MD and PhD from Harvard with your PhD on neuronal stem cells and the effects on the CSF. Yes. He's also published numerous scientific articles on the CSF and is also the director of the Regenerative Medicine and Clinical Research at UCLA in the Greater Los Angeles area and the healthcare system. And he's also served as a chief resident there. You're also the director of the Regenerative Medical and Clinical Research at Synovation Medical Group. Dr. Zapatera combines his training with various complementary medicine modalities such as polarity therapy, Reiki, and craniosacral therapy, and looks at treating every individual holistically, integrating the body, mind, and spirit. You also research and design new programs and techniques to help alleviate pain and increase quality of life. Dr. Zapatera brings his trainings of alternative therapies to his physical medicine rehabilitation practice and reports fascinating and pioneering discoveries. Mauro Zapatera is a husband, a father, an MD, a PhD, a BCPP, a BCST, Reiki master, and a student of life. Thank you for joining us. I know you're a busy man, and I'm very thankful that you're here, Dr. Zapatera.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm really thankful for that. I know that that's a lot of info about you, but I think it's really important in these times to ensure that people are understanding that what you're chatting about and what you know and what you have researched and the combination, the synergy of the science behind some of the, I suppose some people call it spirituality or woo-woo or some sort of, you know, some of them are ancient teachings as well, but I just wanted to ensure that everyone knew your history, what you have done, where you have been. And I know you're creating new steps. I just feel that I want to say new paradigms in this world of the medical field, combining this research, your understanding on all this, on this complete area, especially the cerebral spinal fluid, which we will talk about very shortly. I sort of want to just start very briefly on how you became interested in the cerebral spinal fluid. Was it, you know, how was it that you really pinpointed that area of the medical research when you were studying or when you were working with, working and studying?
That's a fascinating question. I was in medical school actually, and I was always interested in, our energetic bodies in terms of, I was always interested in things like acupuncture and massage or healing touch and the effect of healing touch and seeing the effect of, you know, even a baby being touched, or, you know, I would have acupuncture sessions, for instance. And there was obviously an understanding of the energetic body that was beyond what we were being taught at medical school. Even in Boston, for instance. And so I've always had this sort of I've always had this curiosity of our body as an energetic being. It's not just the sum of its parts, for instance. There's so much more that goes on into the functioning of the body and just the intricacies and the divine manifestations that occur when these things are actually put together and how they work together and things like that. And so I was always interested in books like Carolyn Mace's Anatomy of the Spirit, you know, how herbs and things like homeopathy affect the body. And in medical school, I knew that I was getting a very formal training of anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, immunology, virology, whatever it might be. And I was doing some research in a cancer lab. And it was actually my wife at the time who I met her, and she was also interested in holistic sort of health care. And she sort of noticed, she's like, you know, you don't seem so happy. It seems maybe like your like the energy and the vigor of why you went to medical school sort of decreased a little bit. And she was totally right. And so she actually encouraged me to take some time off from, I was in the MD PhD program at the time at Harvard Medical School, and she actually encouraged me to take some time off. And so I talked to the, you know, I talked to all the administrators, and they're like, you know, go and, you know, do what you feel like you need to do. We'll keep your spot here. And I was in a cancer lab at the time, and, you know, doing very hardcore research on cancer, oncogenes, you know, all sort of the things that you hear about in the news on cancer research. And so we left, and we actually ended up going to Santa Fe. And in Santa Fe, we started studying polarity therapy. And this was something she had actually found on the internet doing a research of, because she was interested in going to thinking about going to like naturopathy school or something like that. And she just is like, you know, that's not really for me. And so she found this polarity therapy. And when we were reading into it, it just seemed like it matched a lot of both of our interests. And essentially, polarity therapy was started by this individual called Dr. Stone. He was an osteopath. He was a chiropractor. He was a doctor of naturopathic medicine. He had traveled to Egypt. He had traveled to India. He had traveled to China. And he had put together this entire health system, which essentially involved you know, four basic principles, which was healing touch, movement, so energetic postures and movement, diet and nutrition, and then positive mind, sort of thinking, how you know, what are the things. And so I was like, wow, this is really a really good system. And he integrated a whole bunch of different parts from Chinese medicine, from the meridians and acupuncture, from Ayurvedic medicine, and sort of created this healing touch, body-centered healthcare system. In that program, there was an individual who was studying craniosacral therapy. And every Friday, we were having these sessions of craniosacral therapy. And so, you know, to me, I'm sort of one of these people that I feel like maybe I'm a little bit, I was open to this healing touch, because I felt, you know, just by getting a few sessions, for instance, of polarity therapy, I had felt immediate changes in my body and in my psyche. And you know, some person sort of describes it as, if you're creating pure metal, what you do is you boil the metal, boil the metal, boil the metal, boil the metal, and then skim off the top, and you get all the dirt out. And then you boil the metal, you boil the metal, you boil the metal, and then you skim off the top again. And polarity therapy is sort of this boiling of the metal, and then stuff will rise. And so then it's our job to sort of notice it rising, and then skimming it off the top, and kind of get into our pure essence in a way. And this individual started doing craniosacral, which is a very you know, it's a very powerful but subtle healing touch, where you're tapping into, if you, the, just the words, the cranial and the sacrum, the cranium and the sacrum. But it's more than just that. And you're really palpating what they call, you know, the natural pulsations of the body and the energetic system and the fluids. You're not just touching skin. You're sort of seeing, can you palpate the subtle movements of even the fluid within the skin, or of the energy within the tissue itself? And so I was getting these sessions of craniosacral therapy as well as polarity, and I was having these quite incredible energetic releases. I had a knot in the middle of my solar plexus. You could probably say for 5 or 7 years, to be honest with you. And I'd done some work around it, and it was always there, always there. And you know, I got some sessions of craniosacral therapy and polarity therapy. And one day, in the middle of a session, I just start bawling, just start crying out of nowhere. Out of absolutely nowhere, just start crying, and for 20 minutes, just start having this just like release of energy, right? Since from that day on, no, I've not had any solar plexus issues, no tightening of the solar
Wow.
plexus or anything like that. And I would call that, you know, maybe some anxiety, nervousness, stress,
Yeah.
whatever it might be. Totally released. I started noticing when they were doing some sessions of me, just some incredible visions and sensations of what I would consider oneness with the totality of all, for instance. And I can't really describe it beyond that. It just sort of felt like this energy arose or was unveiled. And I felt as if, as cliche as it might be, it was all one, that there was really no separation between this energy and myself, my physical body and myself. And my experiences of this, because I was so interested in it, that what we would do in class and during lunch is some of the students that were interested in this craniosacral therapy, we would literally, like, we would have an hour and a half of lunch, and we would just, for 45 minutes, I would just hold somebody's, I would hold their cranium like this and
Wow.
just really feel, we were taught to get to center ourselves, to neutral, be, center ground, neutral, feel your
Yes.
feet on the ground, center
Yeah.
yourself, ground yourself.
Yeah.
And then we'd, so we'd touch. And even if, I'm kind of like one of those people that even if this does absolutely nothing, if I'm centering, grounding myself and neutralizing myself during this experience, it's sort of it's a good practice for me.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
but I was also palpating, right? And so I'm kind of like a I'm like an open skeptic, let's say. I go into
Okay.
things skeptical,
Yep.
but I've done enough research to be like, there's no way that that's going to happen. And then you set up the experiment and you're like, wow, that was amazing, right? And so
Yeah.
you're open to these possibilities, but you really want to set up the experiments. And so with human personalities and human contact, well, what's the experiment? Well, here's my experience, right? Like,
Yeah.
so here's my experience of holding somebody's occiput for 45 minutes, and we would do this for 4 weeks in a row. And I would have the same, I would have the same. So we would switch, and then they would hold my occiput for 45 minutes. And you'd start feeling just these really subtle sort of pulsations or movements. And what happened during some of those experiences was I really felt like this energy that was all just all pervasive, that I was feeling it. It was almost like it was condensing, and I was feeling it as if it was sort of morphing and condensing itself in my third ventricle. And I had enough, because I had gone to medical school, I had enough understanding of the anatomy that when these sort of subtle, when I felt something subtly, I could try to track it to the anatomy that was present
Brilliant.
in our body, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, that's the third ventricle, right? So I'm feeling this sort of like, it's almost like this, I wouldn't call it, maybe anointing, or just sort of whatever it is, but it sort of felt like it, like a pulsation into the third ventricle. And then from the third ventricle, I was feeling it sort of spread throughout my cranium, spread throughout my entire being, spread throughout my spinal cord, down into my sacrum, spread then throughout my entire body, spread to the, to my hands, and then even beyond, where you would say, well, where do you start and where do you end? That I wouldn't really have I wouldn't have an answer for you, but I wasn't dissociated, because our number one training was grounding yourself, feeling
Yeah.
your back against the table, feeling your butt against the table, really feeling that physical contact of the table. And so that was my, it was sort of like, wow, I really feel this oneness, this lack of boundary of my body, but yet I feel my back on the table. I feel totally grounded in
Yeah,
this experience, right?
yes.
And so I was like, wow, this is really incredible. We need to sort of look at this a little bit closer. And the other, so then, a few days later, I remember the craniosacral teacher said, So I was open. He's like, well, it's really about the movement of the cerebrospinal fluid and how the cerebrospinal fluid is one molecule away from ocean water.
Yes.
And I was like, and so that triggered just an
Absolutely.
enormous amount of, because here I am in medical school going like, I don't think that the cerebrospinal fluid is one molecule away from ocean water, right? Like that would be like, first of all, what is ocean water, saline and this and that? But I know that there's proteins in it, and I know that there's, so I kind of had this, I'm like, that doesn't seem like an accurate statement, right? So there's this discernment that's still occurring, right? So I'm still a scientist, I'm still sort of a medical scientist. That's like, that doesn't seem like an accurate statement. Let me assess that. And when I went to assess that myself, I realized, well, first of all, it's not one molecule away from the ocean. It's many different molecules away from the ocean, but and we can get into the relationship to the ocean in future, in 10 or 15 minutes or whatever. But what happened is I started realizing, so I go into, well, what is known about the cerebrospinal fluid? So at first I asked what's in it, and there was very little known about it. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Here's this fluid, right? That's in the middle of our brain. We have cavities that are formed that have this fluid in it. And I'm like, what is in it? Because I had known that, we were entering into the world of proteomics, which was, characterizing all different types of proteins in systems. Systems biology was blossoming at Harvard. We had some of the best machines to take out a sample of tissue or fluids and analyze it at the sort of at the finest molecular level. And I was like, wow, with all this thing that we have, we don't really know, A, exactly what's in the cerebrospinal fluid, or B, what this fluid actually does. We've always sort of said that it buffers the brain, it helps with nutrition, and it gives electrolytes to the brain. But those were sort of generalized statements of, it's this fluid compartment that the brain is sort of housed in, for instance. And so that question essentially led me down this entire field of trying to understand. The first question was just, what's in this fluid, right? And I went back. So then I had this entire, like, it was sort of like that spark that my wife noticed was gone, all of a sudden reemerged. I go back to Harvard. I change labs. I find somebody who was willing to support me in this question. And it really didn't come until I was looking at these slides of embryos, and I see this slide of an embryo, and the brain, the part of the brain, the part of the embryo that's going to form the brain, and this was an embryo at about 8 weeks. It was a human embryo at about 8 weeks of development. The part of the brain that forms the actual cortex, our thinking part of the brain, was about, I'm trying to sort of show you on camera, but it was about this thin, right? Comparatively. And I was like, I'm like, okay, that's the brain. That's going to become the cortex, what we think about the brain. And then the space between the different parts of the brain was about this large. So there was space in there. And inside this space was a huge cauliflower-like shape. And I go, what's that shape in there? To one of my colleagues who's sitting right next to me, he goes, oh, that's the choroid plexus. And I go, that literally my eyes lit up and was just like, that's the choroid plexus? The choroid plexus was about this big. The cortex that was going to form the brain was about this big. So in comparison, I was like, wait, if that the choroid plexus is the structure that makes the cerebrospinal fluid. So I was like, if that's the choroid plexus and that's creating this fluid has to be important in development. It's just like, what is this fluid doing in development that we've never studied? And that then I started looking at, can we isolate this fluid from embryos? Can we actually study this to see what are the components of this fluid early on in embryologic development, see how this fluid changes, see if we can, you know, culture cells with this fluid. Can this fluid actually sustain life? What do the cells do if they're in contact with the fluid? And so that led to my entire PhD dissertation, which was an incredible experience, probably one of the most challenging things I've ever done in my life, but hugely important for my personal development and everything. Because while I was studying this, while I was in the lab isolating fluid, trying to grow, you know, tissue with different types of fluids and stuff like that, my wife and I had also decided to go and become certified in cranial sacral therapy. So imagine, you know, every 3 months we take off and we fly to Boulder and we go into a 5-day intensive workshop. And so I'm getting this sort of, you know, I'm getting this experience from a cranial sacral perspective. I'm getting sessions, I'm giving sessions, but I'm also getting informed by this fluid by doing, you know, hardcore research in the lab on this. So I was kind of getting this information from all these multiple sources and sort of putting it together. And that's when, you know, I defended my PhD and then my let's say interest in the fluid as a potential conveyor of what I call sort of the source energy into our physical bodies became more that, you know, that became sort of more of my personal research or practice. And so that's obviously a long answer, but it really is that complex in terms of how did I get to that? Because, you know, my wife was hugely instrumental in guiding me. This guy, Jeffrey Wilson, you know, who was doing craniosacral therapy and said, you know, hey, it's one way, you know, it's one molecule away from seawater, and having that skeptical of like, no, let's not really take everything that people say, you know, as truth. Is that really true? Right. It wasn't true, but it didn't matter because the fact that it wasn't true, it's like, well, what is in the cerebrospinal fluid so that we really know? And then it was sort of like, oh, we don't really know what is in the cerebrospinal fluid. So can we find out? I was sort of in a perfect position to say, can we find out? And, you know, I go back to Harvard and across the street from me is the guy who is, you know, the world expert in proteomics and how to, you know, isolate proteins out of a fluid. And so I go over to him and I say, look, I want to, you know, study the cerebrospinal fluid. And he's like, great, bring me a sample of a fluid, right? And it was just, you know, it what was funny is we didn't know what to expect. And so, and that's the cool part of reason is, you know, I bring him this fluid, it's totally clear. And I know that there were some people who literally didn't expect there to be anything. Like just,
right.
You know, yeah. Didn't expect it, just a clear fluid with some salts, some, you know, sodium chloride, maybe, you know, potassium, stuff like that, but that we wouldn't really find, you know. And I remember I get the call from him and he says, and I was talking to my boss at the time and he says, I got your analysis back. And I go, oh, great. You know, did you find anything? He's like, oh yeah. You know, there's about 277 proteins that we found. And I was like, you know, my eyes just dropped. And my boss looks at me and he goes, well, did he find anything? Right? Is there anything in the fluid? And I'm like, he found something.
Yeah, and, cool.
And I remember sort of leaving his office and running across the street and looking at it and being like, wow, this is, you know, like this was our first, you know, sort of large analysis of the proteins in the cerebrospinal fluid. And that then led to other studies and really characterizing the proteins. And, you know, if anybody's interested in sort of reading the whole dissertation, it is on my website at holdingspace.com for free. You can just download it and have it. But, you know, it goes into various sort of experiments of what we did with the cerebrospinal fluid itself, how it changes from the embryo into adults. And then sort of, you know, our hypotheses of what it did, very specific experiments on what it did, you know, using both mice and rats, as models and really characterizing it. And now, you know, if you pick up Time magazine or the New York Times, the cerebrospinal fluid has sort of exploded
yes.
as a hugely important fluid that now we're starting to understand as, wow, this is really important.
And
really
incredible.
I just love that because it's starting to show, you know, some of the importance of this fluid and things that, I mean, just some of the, you know, some of the interesting discoveries that have made in terms of what it's doing to our brains during sleep and how it's cleansing our brains during sleep and how these pulsations of fluid through our brain and all that just gets into, you know, so many numerous pathways of discussions that, you know, I'll just leave it at that and see.
Oh God,
where
yeah,
you
look,
go.
Yeah, you've opened a door to new paradigms, you know, and to a new way of being, to an understanding that, I mean, it must have been so exciting to actually get that fluid and say, let's see what's in it and just get that information back and to be experiencing like the medical research and then doing your craniosacral therapy and just understanding both worlds is really
that's exactly what was happening. Yep.
It's quite unique to the medical field. And to understand how it works, like in all areas, energetically and physically, is just so, it's such a breakthrough. It's so great because you're experiencing it yourself and you're able
exactly.
to speak from not just it's my experience, but experience that involves your your research and your deep understanding through the study that you've done. So it's just brilliant. It's a very exciting time, really, to be understanding and to be where you are and really at the beginning, at the press, you know, of what is going to just, God, become something so, so, so important for us in future generations to understand. And I think, you know, you have started, like I said, I was looking years ago for information about this, you know, cerebral spinal fluid, about how it works. And I heard the one molecule away from seawater and I was like, really? How does that work? How do I find out more about that? And you were the only person that came up. And there were only a few YouTube videos of you back then talking about the cerebrospinal fluid, but there's a lot more available now, which I'm glad to hear and see, and also on your holdingspace.com website. So there's a lot of information there. I know you've got your blog and your meditations and all your information. So, Dr. Zapatero, what I'd like to ask you is, obviously, CSF is really filled with proteins and affects our lives in different ways, but we don't have all day to talk about this, and I would love to, but obviously there are certain aspects of the cerebral spinal fluid that works through the body and with the body, physically and energetically. How does it affect our life and our body if we are connecting to the cerebral spinal fluid consciously?
So first of all, let's go through some of the roles that we absolutely know that it does. All right. So
okay.
We know that the cerebral spinal
fluid. You're the expert.
What's that?
That'd be good, knowing that you're the
yeah,
expert.
So let's know, yeah. You know, so let's it's hugely important in development. It bathes your entire, every single cell that becomes your nervous system is mm-hmm. bathed in the cerebrospinal fluid when you're a tiny little embryo in your mother's womb. So I'm publishing a book on this, on these sorts of concepts, which are also present in my talks. But that's, you know, so first of all, that's hugely important because every single cell mm-hmm. that develops into our nervous system was bathed in this fluid in the womb as an embryo. We know that, you know, even as an embryo, it's transporting nutrients, very important nutrients. It's transporting hormones. It's transporting growth factors.
Mm-hmm.
It's still doing that today. We know mm-hmm. of growth factors, for instance, in the cerebrospinal fluid that are helping in terms of developing new neurons and things like that. So it's already, we already know it to be a signal for growth factors. Okay. It regulates things like circadian rhythms, which is our sleep-wake cycle. And so there's a lot of studies that have been done in terms of melatonin being released into the cerebrospinal fluid by the pineal gland. And the pineal gland is in the posterior part of our third ventricle. And that's
Sure.
secreting melatonin when the when our visual cortex gets when our eyes see less light, melatonin starts to be released by the pineal gland, and you see concentrations of melatonin dramatically increase in the cerebrospinal fluid. And then if you don't, you know, if you just accept these rhythms as natural rhythms of life and not try to stay up and watch your favorite show or you know whatever it is, and when it gets dark enough, you just you get tired and you close your eyes, you'll then fall into a sleep. And so it's regulating circadian rhythms through the transport of things like melatonin. It regulates things like appetite. So there are actually proteins found in the CSF that control appetite. It creates an ionic balance. So, you know, the importance of electrolytes and sort of creating an ionic balance for cells, sort of homeostasis, right? It eliminates waste. It's number one waste eliminator, for instance, in our brain. And what they've just shown is amazingly. So imagine, so you know, we all think of like this cerebrospinal fluid being housed in these ventricles and around the outside of the brain, and the ventricles are those little cavities inside the brain. And what was fascinating when we had done the analysis was that we had looked at the analysis of the proteins, and we found a lot of what we call extracellular matrix proteins in it. Extracellular matrix, if you just kind of take that word apart, extra means outside of, cellular means outside of the cell. So extracellular matrix, and then the matrix is sort of this interconnection, this web of proteins. And what we found was that we actually found these proteins in the cerebrospinal fluid, but it was just, it wasn't in between cells, it was in a liquid. So I sort of described it as a less differentiated form, like a more liquid form of the extracellular fluid that you find between cells. And amazingly, the new discoveries came out that showed that while we sleep, we actually sort of, our brain has these little channels or sort of opens up to these pulsations and flow of cerebrospinal fluid from the ventricles into the brain tissue itself, and it clears out, it eliminates the waste that was building up during the day from just our normal thinking, whatever it might be, and it eliminates that waste. And so sleep and the function of the cerebrospinal fluid and sleep is hugely important in terms of we need to get, finally, we're understanding why we need to get sleep, because sleep is so important for cleansing our brain from the toxins that build up during the day. And this is actually done by the brain changing the way that its proteins are structured such that the cerebrospinal fluid can flow, because usually it doesn't flow so much from the ventricles into the brain itself, but can actually flow from the ventricles into the brain tissue, clears it out, and then gets resorbed into the body and goes back into our system and gets, you know, it becomes blood again, and then we purify it, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, one of the things that if people ask is like, well, what is the, you know, what is the main function of the C at this point? Like what I would say is from a, you know, from what we know from a very, it cleans the brain and it brings transports, it brings, it tra plant transports nutrients, it transports hormones, it transports growth factors, it transports things like melatonin. But it cleans the brain when we sleep, and therefore we need to get a good amount of sleep so that we can open up these channels, the CSF can flow through, and then let's say these channels open and now we're up, we have a clean, we you know, we have a clean brain in essence. We can think,
That's
you know,
great.
we
So what, okay, this might sound a really naive question, but when you say clean the brain and the toxins of the brain, I mean, what does that mean when, you know, because what's happening in the brain that we are we're creating toxins. How does that work? What do you mean?
Everything. Reactive oxygen species that build up from just normal metabolism. Just the normal metabolism of thinking and being alive will create, you know, will create sort of toxins or garbage that needs to be disposed of properly. It happens all the time. It's not anything that is, you know, it's not anything that's bad or wrong. It just happens through normal metabolism. So, you know, our bodies are really good at doing things like that. But when we force it, when we don't do things like that, like when we don't get good enough enough sleep, or when we, whatever it might be, that the toxins can build up. And if the toxins build up enough, then, you know, there's a certain sort of concentration of, let's say, reactive oxygen species that below a certain concentration, they're not having so much effect on cells or cell membranes or DNA or anything like that. So they're not ruining anything. Once they get to a certain concentration, then they start ruining, you know, they start damaging cells and they start damaging tissues and things like that. And so we want to eliminate those. And the cerebrospinal fluid comes in and sort of, you know, what we think of it as doing is it just sort of comes in and it washes everything away. Okay. And, you know, so it's not anything that, you know, it's not like when I say toxin, like, oh, you're totally, you know, you have all these toxins building up. This is just natural metabolism that occurs that creates these sort of byproducts that if they sit around and they get too high in concentration, that they start to damage the cells. We have a great way of, you know, our blood supply constantly replenishing things. And our CSF, if we sleep, constantly replenishing things, coming in and sort of clearing it out, no big deal. But if you don't do it, now the studies are going to be done that, okay, if people don't get sleep, do the toxins really build up, and do they cause things like Alzheimer's, dementia? Do they cause things like, you know, headaches, for instance, like when you wake up in the morning and you have a headache, could that be that the cerebrospinal fluid didn't clear the toxins well throughout, you know, that built up throughout the day or whatever it might be? We don't know the answers to those questions yet, but my hypothesis would be that we'll probably find something like that, you know, we'll notice that the importance of sleep is really to help decrease these toxins that just build up, so that over time they don't get stuck in the brain and cause things like neurodegeneration or dementia or things like that. And then the other aspect of that would be, well, does that happen only during sleep? Because sleep would be, let's say, an altered sense of consciousness. And so could you actually induce that during states of meditation or during profound states of parasympathetic response? You know, sleep, we sort of think of like a parasympathetic activity. And so therefore, you know, could getting healing touch work where you get into this really deep state of relaxation, even if it's for 20 or 30 minutes, could that create this sort of opening and the flow of the cerebrospinal fluid through your brain tissue? Could deep states of meditation cause that? And so those are questions that are just interesting to me, because I doubt that it's just during sleep, right? There's some sort of physiologic response of the nervous system being in a very, very restful state, being feeling like it's totally supported, and then all of a sudden something opens up. Now that the let's say the little gateways that were holding the cerebrospinal fluid in the ventricles now opens up, and it allows it into the parenchyma. This is my hypothesis. It hasn't been studied yet. We need to do the same studies that they did with the fMRIs and all those cool things that they looked at, in terms of people being in deep states of meditation and seeing, does that actually cause this same cerebrospinal fluid flow? But I would, you know, I would sort of, my hypothesis is that it does. So that's just kind of something to think about. You know, if you go into a state of meditation, you feel really clear or rejuvenated afterwards. Was there some mechanism that actually was able to open in the brain that caused this cerebrospinal fluid to flow? And then, you know, from a more what I call not yet fully studied perspective, is you know, this concept of, of the cerebrospinal fluid as being a vehicle and a conductor of energy. And so we know that it conducts molecules. We know that it transports nutrients and growth factors. We know that it transports melatonin. We know that there's this pulsation. We know that it moves. We know, for instance, that our breath can control the flow of the CSF. We know that our heart rate can control the movement of our CSF in our bodies. And so my, you know, all I tell people is look at the anatomy of the ventricles, study the anatomy of where the fluid is, study the anatomy of the third ventricle, which is this midline space that's sort of a vertical sort of wall like this with, you know, with the pituitary gland in front, the pineal gland in back. Know how it connects to the lateral ventricles, which are these amazing ventricles on both sides of your hemispheres. Know that there's a tube that goes all the way down the central part of your spine. So in your spine, you have a tube, right? You have a hole that goes all the way down. And in that hole, there's cerebrospinal fluid in that little hole that goes down. It goes all the way down your spinal cord and on the outside as well. And it bathes your entire, it goes all the way down to like S1 in your, or S2 or S3 in your sacrum. So you have a sacral pool. You have a ventricular pool. You have a, you know, a, in the back of your head, the cisterna magna. So we have all these kind of pools of cerebrospinal fluid. And wherever it might be interesting to you, just bring your awareness. Just bring your awareness to the fluid and say hello to it. Recognize it as a part of you. Mm. And that's it. That's it. That's all you need to do. That's all you need to do. And see what happens. Just see what happens in your experience, in your own experience, of saying hello to this fluid and kind of having an understanding of the parts of the brain that it's contacting to. And that, you know, that's really where I sort of, I allow them people to do that. And then, you know, and then send me emails and be like, you know, whatever it might be, or connect to, you know, to, you know, make analogies to different things that they've experienced in life. And that's the beauty is I'm not necessarily, I don't want to like put experiences into people's consciousness. I want it to sort of emerge out of them and to be authentic to you, right? Like, what is your experience of this? Not what my experience is. I know what my experience is, but what's your experience of this? You might be able to tell what my experience is. But the point of this is that when you're doing this, that you don't dissociate, number one. Okay, so you're not like floating away. Okay?
Yep.
You don't feel like your soul is
grounded.
Exactly. You're embodied. Okay.
Yes.
This body
is a sacred vessel.
It's a totally sacred vessel. It's amazing that we're in this body. It's a miracle. Yes. All right.
Totally.
And so feel your feet on the ground throughout this entire process. If simultaneously you're not feeling your feet on the ground as you're connecting to this fluid, Then I encourage you to really just practice feeling your feet on the ground and simultaneously, for instance, feeling your entire body. So it's, to me, it's all about staying grounded. It's all about feeling your thighs against the chair, your back against the chair, or if you're lying down, you know, and not becoming disassociated or not even leaving your body. It's actually about remaining embodied and connecting to the fluid and seeing what happens as a vehicle of transmission of what I call sort of source energy, of the totality of energy that exists in the universe, that unifying energy that is present for all, that informs us all. And so, you know, just see what happens. And that's
Yeah, well, that's great advice as well for the simplicity of it and understanding the cerebral spinal fluid as you see it, but understanding that we're all unique. Our experience is going to be very different for each of us, and how we feel and see that is going to be unique to us. But your wisdom and your information and your research upon it all really helps us understand it on a deeper level. But the simplicity of having your feet on the ground, connecting to the cerebral spinal fluid and just working with that, just to understand it a little bit more each time is really, yeah, is really basically what you're saying. And I love simplicity. I think it's really important in the world that we live in. We'll leave all the hard research and all the interesting, intricate work to you, but bringing it all back for just the general person that wants to understand the cerebral spinal fluid. It is a fluid. It works through us. It is in our brain and it works through our entire system is what I felt before I even knew too much about it. I know that you call it one of your YouTube videos, it's a vehicle of transmission of information that you called it. And there's you said there's no synapse, there's synchronization and it's simultaneous. So it's all sort of happening all at once, but it's becoming quite apparent as you speak, Dr. Zapatero, that it's really simply getting in touch with the ground, connecting, and then connecting to the fluid within you and seeing what comes from there.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's really
and I think yes, that's it. That's really how simple, because if you're having an authentic experience, and I ground all this in the anatomy, right? So I tell people to go look at the anatomy of the ventricles, which is why you see anatomy of the ventricles on my talks, for instance.
Yes,
look at where the pituitary gland is compared to the pineal gland in the third ventricle.
Yes.
If you feel drawn to the third ventricle in your meditation or in your closing of your eyes or whatever happens, or all of a sudden you feel an energy coalescing there, notice it. Just notice it and say hello.
Yes.
Right? Just say hello. Hello. Wow. What?
Yeah.
Be a 2-year-old that's investigating like a flower for the first time and just say hello. Whatever you feel, totally authentic to your own experience. And these might be really subtle feelings, but you know, just sort of stay with it. And the more the more you practice, the more these little subtle feelings will not be so subtle anymore. And just say hello, whatever you feel. If you feel coalescing, if you feel a spreading, if you feel a tightening, whatever it is, just be curious at it as it, and just say hello to it and see what happens. But remain grounded, stay in your chair, have your feet on the ground. And that might be the first process of it is just feeling your feet on the ground, and simultaneously feeling your body, so feeling your feet on the ground and then feeling your body. That might be somebody's initial practice of this. And then going in and seeing where, some people might even feel it coalescing in their sacrum, wherever it does, but just being authentic to yourself and knowing that this, you have a physical anatomy in you that has been, that for whatever reason has the shapes and the spaces that they do. And,
yeah.
and go with, if you start feeling something moving, is it moving in some sort of energetic pattern, or is it actually moving in some sort of anatomic pattern? And, you can even flow with that, almost like you're just watching it, right? You're kind of watching it. It might be flowing, or you might start feeling it pulsating or gathering or increasing in intensity or whatever it might be for you. You might feel it going down your spine. You might feel it coming up your spine. You might feel it expanding out. You might feel it. And as you said, this brings me back to what you said is, remember, you have extracellular fluid throughout your entire body, right? So you might feel it coalescing from the periphery to the center. You might feel it from the center to the periphery.
Yes.
You might feel it as like a spreading, as for instance, if I took like a food dye, a food color, and put one drop into a bottle of water and watched it just, move. And now all of a sudden you're breathing into that bottle of water. And how the food dye then starts to move. And now that, to me, that's sort of like if and when you connect to that source, that food dye that source gets dropped in, boom, it's always there anyways. And then you might feel it sort of going out, and then instantaneously, you might feel it, you know, at your fingertips, or at your thing, you know, at your toes, or even sort of beyond your physical body. There may be a sensation of something being beyond your physical body, in that. And so, you know, we do have extracellular matrix throughout our entire body. And so people may be feeling it also in the extracellular matrix. Once the fluid has been informed and has a certain resonance or frequency to it, that you might feel it in other parts of your body too, or even, you know, a holistic sort of entire body experience.
Yeah. And I suppose the thing to remember is there is no right or wrong way to feel or to do it. It's just to connect to the ground and just be with, you know, be there with, you know, yourself and the cerebral spinal fluid, and just be grounded at that, because our experiences are all so unique.
That is absolutely right. Yep.
Yeah. Look, I've probably taken up a lot of more of your time than planned, but I did want to mention, look, you relate the CSF to so many things. It's relatable to the Kundalini and the awakening. I've also noticed on the latest blog, I don't know if you write those, but it's there's a metaphor to Frozen 2 and the Kundalini there, which is really interesting. I really would love the listeners to connect to your website, because it's a wealth of information. Not only is there a blog, but they can connect to you in relation to their experience. There are meditations on there, and that's holdingspace.com, and that's a plethora of information that people can connect to, and to your information that you have studied, and also just YouTube, Google your name, and it'll come up with different things that you've done over the last few years. I'm glad to see that this information is becoming more and more exposed, Dr. Zapatera, because I think it's time. It's obviously time, because it's here. And I really felt it was a few years ago now that I initially was looking at your information, and I had a very distinct feeling that you were here to, because your name anyway, to ground this information and to share it anyway. So I'm so glad that now, 4 years down the track, you are grounding this information in more ways than one, and you're able to share your research, and it's becoming readily available and acceptable and understood, not just by, you know, not just by people like myself who are sitting in a lounge, but by medical, you know, medical researchers, medical doctors are recognizing your research. So thank you so much. So I want to say thank you for your research. Thank you for being inspired back then and following that inspiration, because I think that's where it all starts for the shifts to occur. And you're bringing through so much information that is going to be so important for many of us as we move forward through humanity and evolve to the next stages. So I want to say thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for your information. I didn't have to ask you anything. You were just a wealth of information. And I just want to ask, as I ask all my guests, if you have one message for the world at this time, what would it be?
if you my had a message for the world is, yeah, go towards love.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, that works. Brilliant. Thank you again, Dr. Mauro Zapatera from holdingspace.com, and for your research. And may you go in peace, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. I'll stop recording. And I don't know if you're interested in the link, but I will send it to you anyway.
Great.